This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are people around you who really have done heroic things for the sake of our freedom. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we are educated, we're certainly entertained, and oftentimes even inspired by these stories from America's greatest generation. Inspired, moved, and humbled would be a few of the words that describe what I felt this week after an amazing honor flight experience with 66 veterans from California. You've heard me talk about the Honor Flight Network, volunteers all over the country making it possible for World War II veterans to visit their memorial in Washington, D.C., and to do so free of charge. It's happening in every area where Hometown Heroes is on the radio, and I've encouraged you before to get involved with Honor Flight wherever it is that you live. Where I live is Central California, and if you're a longtime listener to the show, perhaps you followed the development of Central Valley Honor Flight, which, thanks to unbelievable community support, just concluded a remarkable first year of flying. Wednesday, October 29th marked 1 year since the first Central Valley Honor Flight took off from Fresno. And on Wednesday, October 29th, 2014, our fifth flight in those 12 months came home. 66 veterans and their guardians touching down on the historic runway of the former Castle Air Force Base in Atwater to a giant red, white, and blue crowd and some incredibly emotional moments. The Atwater High School band was there playing all the military hymns. The cheerleaders from Buhack Colony High and Merced High were there with their pom-poms. Countless color guards forming an avenue of flags, and the veterans wrapping up a three-day experience with the homecoming of a lifetime. 62 men and 4 women from 8 different counties in California, and every single one of them has a story to tell. We had a sailor who survived the sinking of the USS Yorktown, men who were wounded at the Battle of the Bulge, 4 female veterans on the flight, including 2 Navy waves, and we're going to hear from another wave and an anecdote that's sure to give you a chuckle. They represent all branches of the military, many different ethnicities. They range in age from the mid-80s to 98. That was our oldest vet, and he still runs an exercise class in Merced. But at least one thing that they all have in common, a love for our country. I hope to bring you some more of their stories in the future, because there are some doozies, but we're going to hear from a few of the folks on that flight today. This first one was recorded while we were at the World War II Memorial. The entire group stood at attention as an 88-year-old Army veteran, Donald Dick of Visalia, played taps on his father's World War I cavalry bugle. And then the veterans and their guardians fanned out to take in this memorial built in their honor. I noticed one veteran had finished touring the memorial and he'd settled into a spot to rest, so I struck up a conversation. And once I started talking, I decided I better record some of this for you, because it was pretty incredible stuff. You'll hear the rush of the World War II Memorial's fountain in the background, and you'll hear from Charles Steins, who was there with his son Daryl, serving as his guardian. Well, Mr. Steins, first of all, what does it mean to be here at the National World War II Memorial and see what America and many of your fellow World War II veterans have built for you?
Well, it's amazing. I believe the most interesting thing to me is the humane factor of what the people are doing now for us, the volunteer work that goes into it, and showing to take us and help us see this beauty and see what we've done.
And I imagine it means something to you to share this with your only son.
Oh, absolutely. He is an Army veteran also. He was in Korea up on the DMZ in the Army of Occupation for 18 months. So he has a little flavor of the Army in combat.
And he wouldn't be here if you didn't survive World War II, and that wasn't easy for you. You went in before Pearl Harbor. Where were you on December 7th, 1941?
I was in a rental automobile coming down from Fort Lewis, Washington on my very first furlough. I got down to Portland, Oregon when it came on the radio, and they said, all military personnel get back to your base. So I had a half a day of that furlough. I went through the entire war. I went through 4 years and never again even started on another furlough. I never had a chance.
Thanks a lot. And you ended up in the 3rd Infantry Division, you say the 15th Infantry Regiment?
Right, that's right.
You ended up in the invasion of North Africa?
I made the beach landings and made the invasion. We went in at Casablanca and then turned and went across through the Atlas Mountains into Tunisia, and we got stopped by Rommel. Field Marshal Rommel put a stop to our advance.
There aren't too many of you left that were part of that early action for America in World War II. How severe were those circumstances? How fearful were you that your life might end there?
I mastered my fear. I was always responsible for a group of men, and they were my primary interest. I was so busy watching out and making sure everything went right that I didn't have time to worry about myself, which was a lifesaver for me.
I guess so. And what kind of unit was that? That was an infantry, a rifle platoon, or what?
It was a regular rifle platoon. We had three platoons of riflemen and one platoon of heavy weapons, and I was in charge of the machine gun section through most of the early days of the war. Later on, I got promoted out of my job, so I lost my machine gunners, but that was what I loved and what I did best.
And you said you guys were driven out by the Desert Fox there, General Rommel. I imagine that means there were heavy casualties. Did you lose a lot of friends there?
Quite a few. I lost a brother-in-law who happened to be in the same outfit. But actually, we don't say Rommel drove us out. We just retreated a little bit. We withdrew. We didn't retreat. We didn't go very far. He only wanted to get through to get on a boat and go back to Germany. So we got by pretty good. The original soldiers that came, landed over there and fought, they took very, very heavy casualties in the Tunisian area. They were right up against the desert there, against Rommel. The German army was good enough to hold them there. Then we never made any advance into the desert, so it was a rough war.
Well, and now you can look back and you know what happened, but at the time, when you're facing that, you're overmatched, you've lost your brother-in-law. I mean, that had to be pretty hard to deal with. How did you get through those kind of challenges?
I didn't have time to think about that. I had to live in the present day-to-day and just do the best you can. I think most of us that were in combat after the first few days realize you're not coming back, so quit worrying about it. Just do your job. And that's the way it turns out. So I think we had the right mentality to survive.
Well, you made it here. You must have done something right. Did you have some close calls there in North Africa?
Every few minutes, I guess.
Can you give us an example?
Well, I can't remember a very close call down there. One of the things I remember about North Africa was my first time I got to meet General Patton. It was early in the morning. I had a machine gun roadblock on a road. We hadn't gotten into town yet, and General Patton came up on a light tank behind me, and he asked me if there's any reason he couldn't go to Casablanca. And I said, well, nobody's been in there yet. He said, that's not reason enough. And he kicked his driver and went into Casablanca by himself. A great man.
So those people who say our blood and his guts, you say no, he had plenty of that himself, huh?
Oh, yes. I met him again in Sicily. We were going advancing from the south up towards the north coast, and we were advancing through a German depot, ammo depot, and it had been set afire and ammunition was blowing up and exploded all across the road, and we came to a fork in the road. And General Patton was standing out there directing traffic. His Jeep was turned upside down on the side. I asked him what happened. He recognized me, and I said, what happened? He says, oh, we hit a damn landmine. The driver was dead, but he didn't get hardly hurt. But the thing that amazed me, he was standing there cool as a cucumber directing us down the different routes where we belonged, where we went.
Did you ask him to hold his Pearl pistol?
No, you don't ask General Patton anything. You don't tell him anything either.
You mentioned going over to Italy as well. What do you remember about the landing you made there? Can you paint a picture for us to understand what you saw and experienced at that time?
That was our worst landing, because now we're coming into the European country proper. It's not the same as taking an island or taking some land. Sicily was a rough fight because they wanted to hold us back as far and as long as possible. But you mentioned little incidents, and one that always comes to mind is as we were advancing across Sicily, we came to the Italians built rock walls everywhere. We come to a rock wall, and you had to go over it. So I told my men to hold up. I was going to go over and see what was on the other side, and put my rifle on my back, went over the wall, and landed on the back of a German. And, of course, I grabbed him in a bear hug. My rifle was on my back, and I kicked his rifle over against the wall. I found out in a minute, because he kept hollering at me, "Achtung, Achtung, Minen, Minen." He's planting landmines. He'd planted a whole field in mine. That was his job, and he just finished planting it in mines, and he kept wanting me to stop dancing around and not kick one of the landmines. So anyway, I told my man to hang on, don't shoot him. I was sending a German over the wall and send a runner back to company headquarters and tell them that it was all mine. We couldn't go through there. Anyway, that was a memorable part of my campaign in Sicily.
I would say so, and I know you're not asking for this, but it strikes me that if you hadn't figured that out, a lot of guys could have lost their lives.
Oh, well, we saved each other's life every few minutes in that war. We all looked out for each other. And I remember one time in Italy, I had a combat patrol. I was going on a very narrow path with a rock wall on my left and a cliff on the right. And I had a first scout out, and I was second. Something caught my eye, and a German hand grenade landed right by my feet. I just reached down, scooped it up, and threw it back over the wall. Didn't even think about it. But it went off just as I went over the wall, and I heard a German screaming, so I got him. Anyway, just little incidents like that. You help each other, and you don't think about your own safety. You don't have time. You can't afford it.
Until you're actually wounded.
Yes, finally, I'd been promoted to staff sergeant about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We're getting ready to build up an attack to cross the river. I got promoted to staff sergeant and given charge of the whole platoon. And I thought, well, that's pretty nice. And that was about 4 hours before an artillery landed and took me and my first scout out. And that was the end of the war for me.
How close to you did that shell hit?
My first scout was about 15 feet in front of me, and the shell landed between us and killed him instantly. So somewhere between nothing and 12 feet, you know, it was right there. I heard it coming, but it was so close by the time I heard it, it went off just before I hit the ground.
Do you remember that first scout's name?
No.
It probably was hard to remember names with so many coming and going, huh?
Hard for me to remember your name now.
Mine's not important, but those gold stars over there, there's 4,000 of them representing 400,000 Americans who died in the war. And does that make you think of people like that scout? Because that could have been you, right?
No, you do. You think back on people, but there's so many. Like I said, in one battle, the last battle of Sicily, it was our final attack. We were trying to break down the reserve, keep them from getting back to Italy. We fought for 5 days and nights. In one night alone, we lost 41 men, and we were down to about 180. So they go come and go so fast. You get a new man today, and tomorrow he's gone. So you don't remember. It's over and over and over again, you know.
How many of those who you started with were still there when you were wounded?
There was 12 men of the original 124 left that night. The Italians had given us, was passing out free bottles of beer to us. They were so grateful. So we had a little party that night, and we got together, and we asked all the old-timers to get together, and there were 12 of us.
Wow, that was less than 10% of what they started with. We're going to take our first break, but when we come back, Mr. Steins will describe the extent of his injuries. And I think, like I am, you might be amazed that he's still with us. 93 years old. It's amazing he even survived the war. If he didn't, his son Daryl would have never been born. We're going to hear from Daryl as well. And if you'd like to learn more about Central Valley Honor Flight or any of the Honor Flight hubs around the country, just go to honorflight.org and find that group in your area. Hometown Heroes is coming right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real a sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.